This is a continuation of the interview with Cheryl Cartwright, taking place today, the 21st of February 2011, at Old Parliament House in the Museum of Australian Democracy. Cheryl, thanks for continuing with the interview. Last time we reached the point where you had started working for Alexander Downer in opposition. But we didn't really discuss the nature and routines of that work or any insights into Alexander Downer himself, which we are interested in, of course. So could we take it from there?
Sure. I think when I first went to work for him, I'd not done anything like that before. I'd never had an intray and an outray as a journalist. So it was picking it up as I went, but also responding, as you do when you work for a politician, you respond to what their career goals are and their values are. And pretty soon after I started, he let me know that as he'd taken the job as Shadow Treasurer because he was wanting to be leader, which would have been a shock to a lot of people because he wasn't held in terribly high esteem in those days. As I got to watch him operate, I discovered that while he needed to be managed because he had a tendency to go off on a tangent and do sort of unpredictable things, if you could manage him and use his get his brain working the right way, very, very intelligent man, very enthusiastic and not afraid of hard work. So while I was learning how to be a media and political advisor, he was also learning how to campaign to be leader, and he'd done a lot of the work. He said after the unlosable election in 93, the day after that, he had started courting the wits of the party, and he'd softened his right-wing views, and it just proceeded from there. So I didn't start until, I think, the April or the May after the election. But we started fairly quickly to make some serious changes, which he resisted every single change I tried to impose, but he eventually did what I'd suggested. And I was operating purely from a gut feel, having worked in the press gallery, knowing that while other leaders like Houston and then after him Howard down the track would use the media outside the press gallery to get the point across, the media outside the press gallery actually take their cue from the press gallery itself. So your biggest aim there is to get the opinion leaders in the Canberra press gallery to write a feature or say positive things in passing or a major feature. And then it starts to filter through to the other media. And, excuse me, that was the aim. And it was, rather than seeking a headline day to day, it was a long-term strategy so that nothing he said would be outside the long-term plan of, it was a long-term plan of credibility and to be statesmanlike. And when you're a practical joker and you like having a lot of fun, that's really hard to get the twinkle out of the eye and the grin off the face when you're talking about serious matters. But we had it, because I had a good working relationship with the press gallery, it worked pretty well. I'd be up in the gallery nearly every day, just wander through. Sometimes it would take 5 minutes and sometimes it would take a couple of hours, depending on what stories were around and the feedback I was getting. Now, media advisors in the current government, when they ask me what to do, I tell them just go to the press gallery and talk to people. And just building up a rapport with the journalists, if they are eyeballing you every day and they feel a sense of not necessarily friendship but camaraderie, if they're doing a tough story, they'll let you know, but they'll also soften it a little bit. They don't realise they are, but they are softening it if they know you. And it's amazing that in any government, there are only one or two media advisors who spend time in the gallery, and they're seen as the best media advisors. again, it was just a gut feel that was the way to do it. So then there are lots of little tricks that you do. When you're working from opposition, you don't have a lot to announce, so you have to get in on the back of other stories. So whatever somebody says, and Shadow Treasury is a good portfolio to have, whatever the government announces or whatever stats come out from the ABS, the Shadow Treasurer can say something. And if you say it at the right time with the right grab, you'll keep getting a run. Mm-hmm. So it was when he first told me he wanted to be leader, I said, I'll give it a couple of years. We'll have a 2-year plan. He was leader a year later. And I think that I can't take full credit for it, because the guy actually put the work in. He did all the lobbying with the backbenchers and with his party. He learnt, he was very good at media, just needed a little bit of a rounding out. And he's got the brains to do it. And it's a real shame that it didn't work when he did become leader, but he was a very, very good Shadow Treasurer. Yeah.
Was there an occasion where you had like a significant meeting where you sit down and you devise a strategy of the type you've described, or does it just
It sort of evolves, but you do, the offices are so small. It was him and me. We had an economic advisor, and that was the only staff he officially had, but he moved one of his electorate positions to Canberra to just do the general office work and filing. And the strategy, he said this is what he wanted. Then we would just go through, sometimes on a daily basis, well, this is what you need to do to get there. And today you are saying X, or he would know what he wanted to say, then I would tailor it to be palatable to the media for the longer term plan, and so that he would retain credibility. And remember, this was a time during an economic upturn, and he was, so he had to welcome economic figures, and because he was a bit of a joker from time to time. We did have some negative figures one day, and he was dancing around the office saying, yay, I can say something negative at long last. But what he was able to do, and I think, was welcome the figures, but he would always be able to find something that was a possible problem. Watch for this, because Labor doesn't manage this sort of thing very well. So he'd have a credible comment, and it would just be on the back of things. But what we ended up doing, which was a little bit naughty, but we had lunch with all the radio journalists at one stage. And again, this was good for getting the journos to know that this was a fun guy. Good brains, crack jokes all during lunch. And it just so happened that they're all females except for one. And we had we made a girls' lunch with all my female journo friends. So there were a couple of TV journos, but mainly radio. And out of that came a lament that it was really difficult to get a grab from the opposition for the ABS stats when they came out at 11:30, and they needed something for the midday news. And I said, well, that means if we do that, he's not going to have time to absorb all the detail. So it's just going to be a fairly bland grab. If I roll him out for you for that, then you are not to ask a difficult question. All you're doing is getting, you know, wallpaper for the new, for the news, a gap filler, not a problem. So for the radio only, we used to sneak up the back way at New Parliament House. We'd sneak up the back way into one of the radio offices. I would have sent a note around somehow. I think I rang them, because we didn't have emails or mobile phones when I was there. We certainly didn't have mobile phones sending texts at those days. So I guess I would have just rung one or two of the main 2GB or 2UE, then the radio journos would come to that office with their microphones ready at 10 minutes. The figures came out at 11:30, 10 to 12, they had their radio mics out, wheeled him up there, gave a fairly bland grab about whatever the stats were, and then he was running on radio all afternoon. And then he would then do what they didn't stick to. I said, when we have a proper press conference at 4 o'clock, you've got to turn up. Well, they didn't, but the TVs and print turned up to that, but they didn't. They hadn't found out what we were doing. So that worked well. The other thing we did to get in on the back of other stories was we used the half-hour time difference, Adelaide and Canberra. So Sunday mornings I would watch Business Sunday. Thankfully in those days there was only one TV broadcast to watch on a Sunday. I'd watch Business Sunday, get a gist of, yeah, I think we've got a story here, and call him half an hour, because he was half an hour behind, say, watch this, I think you can get something out of it. He would come up with the line, then we'd polish it. We'd organise a doorstop. Now, he lived in the Adelaide Hills. The TVs are based in Adelaide. So we found a spot. It's no longer there. The Eagle on the Hill is a pub. And we'd say, okay, car park, Eagle on the Hill, pub, 12 midday or 11:30. One of his kids would go down with a tape recorder and tape it. And then as he was going, we'd talk all the way there so that, you know, he'd have the lines right. But as I said, he knew what he wanted to say. I was just polishing it. Had the lines right, had the grabs. So that when, so on his way back, he would play the tape. And because I'd been a secretary, I would type up the transcript, leave a couple of bad words out for him, a couple of phrases out I didn't like in it, type up a transcript, and then go up to the press gallery and hand it around in time for the newspapers to run it the next day. So the transcript carries a heck of a lot more weight than a press release because you actually got the words. And because sometimes we actually got a really good story up, it would actually boost the story from Business Sunday to a normal national story. And sometimes it would get a run on all of the four TV stations on the Sunday night, because they're always looking for a story, and most of the papers on the Monday. And that was just a slog. You did that every weekend, and if there was nothing, you didn't make it up, because you have to retain credibility. So there are lots of little things like that that we did constantly, and he was always, and I know his family used to get cranky, but I could drag him away from a family lunch and say, okay, we've got to do something because we can get you some coverage on this. And he would always, always do it. So he was keen. He was very happy to work hard.
So it sounds like a successful campaign.
Yeah, it was successful. He ended up being leader. Much of everybody's shock. At the start, he actually relates a story. I'd forgotten I'd said it. I tend to be fairly frank. And he'd asked me, when I first started, what did the press gallery think of him? And I said, they think you're an idiot. And he was a little taken aback by that, but it was true. And Laurie Oakes gave me a hard time one time because he had written in his bulletin column when Downer became Shadow Treasurer, this guy's an idiot, what a stupid choice. And at the end of his Shadow Treasury reign, he had to write and say he was wrong. Then when Downer became leader, he wrote a piece saying, don't underestimate this guy, he could be fabulous leader. And then it all fell over, so he teased me about making him wrong twice.
And how did you find Downer as a person? Like, can you talk about his qualities and character at all?
As I said, he could be a lot of fun and challenging and very, very happy to work hard, really keen to work hard. And that was good, but a lot of the time he was an absolute nightmare to work for, and not having worked for a politician before, I didn't realise that there were some that were quite good to work for. So there was a lot of negative feedback and a lot of anger and frustration because I was trying to change things. On the other hand, I could have just not been as stubborn as I am, because I could see the goal, so I was aiming for the goal. And he didn't like the changes when I was trying to make the changes and tell me so in no uncertain terms with lots of language. So if I was perhaps a little not as stubborn, I might have just succumbed and you know, sort of done things his way, and it He would possibly still been leader, but not as fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, when and why did you leave the job with Downer?
Well, it was a different job. When he became leader, I certainly didn't have the skills to be a chief of staff in those days, so I stayed on as a media advisor. And he made some bad choices. He needed... What people hadn't seen was the need to manage him strongly and firmly. Highly skilled, but erratic. And he made some bad choices with the people who were more likely, when he lost his temper, to just back off and agree with him rather than stay there and keep arguing until he finally succumbed. So while it worked with me being strong when he was shadow treasurer, it developed my strength and stubbornness to the point where I've had to learn to tone that back in future jobs, but it was certainly needed with him. Other people who he did get in weren't strong enough until, I've always said this, about 3 or 4 months before he finally succumbed, because I think he only had a good time for about 6 months or 3 to 6 months or something before things started going pear-shaped, they finally moved the person who was running the office and brought in a young person, a young fellow called Brian Loughnane, who's now running the Liberal Party. And Brian was there for the last 3 or 4 months. And I felt that if Brian had been there right from the start, he was much better at managing him. He might have lasted longer, or he might have crashed and burned eventually, but he would have lasted a lot longer. And, you know, then maybe he would have lasted till the election and done a Latham. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? So you just don't know those things. But Brian was brilliant. And I always said, because it was only the short time that I ended up working for him as the chief of staff, if ever I had another chance to work for him, I would. And later on recruited him to be my boss. So that's another story down the track. So it was really hard because in opposition, as when he was leader, because opposition leader isn't a job for the faint-hearted. They've got to be strong and stable and compassionate. Oh, they've got to be everything, and also have good people behind them. Having been a staffer, perhaps I rate the staff a bit more highly than I should, but if you see a leader or a politician making mistakes, their staff are letting them down as well as themselves. Well, as an example, as an aside, I don't know if you'd want to keep this, but Cheryl Curnow failed badly when she joined Labor. The reason she didn't fail when she was leader of the Democrats, she had amazing staff then, and you couldn't tell that it was a staff that were keeping her on track. So same thing happened with Downer. Mm.
And what did you decide to do after you made the decision?
I wanted to leave about a month after he was leader. It was just a horrible, horrible time. Really tough. No one wanted to work for him when he was shadow treasurer because they all thought he was a dill. Once he demonstrated that he was competent and capable, then lots of big egos flocked to the scene in politics. And I got some terrific advice many, many years ago, which was there's only room for one ego in a politician's office, and that's the politician's. And everybody else needs to remember that that's what they're here for. In an opposition leader's office, there aren't many top jobs, and so people want to work in the opposition leader's office as a badge of honour first, then working for the leader second. And they need to reverse that. And in choosing people to work in a leader's office, that's what the person doing the choosing needs to look for. So there were the office was split. Half the office was fighting against the other half of the office, and if that's happening, how can the leader be getting good service?
Mm-hmm.
So it was very difficult to keep it on track. I had a really good relationship with journos, so I would usually find out when things were going wrong because a journo would call and tell me. We didn't have to wait until we saw it in the paper. So we were able to get out and soften and ease that burden. But because I had the connection with the journos, they seemed to think that that was wrong as well, that that was a negative for us because they didn't understand media, the people who were in charge. I also had someone from the media office briefing the journos, one of the juniors in the media office briefing the journos against him. So that doesn't help either. Mind you, you know, there was no story printed that wasn't reasonably accurate, but it could have been better managed. So it was a really tough time. I kept wanting to leave, but some of the stories that were being printed was, you know, that I was in trouble. So if I'd left, it would have looked like I was being kicked out. So I just kept, hanging on and hanging on. And then it just got so bad that towards Christmas in 94, a girlfriend had reached the end of her tether at the job she was doing at the time. And so we both decided that we bought tickets to Around the World tickets, and we planned to leave in February the following year. And I can remember one time we're at the airport. Most of our conversations were at airports, and Alexander said, "So if I do fall over, what do you think you'll do?" And I said, "I think I might just go overseas." I didn't tell him I already had my ticket. So I kind of knew it was, and the timing worked out perfectly because he ended up standing down on Australia Day, 95. And that gave me a few weeks. I ended up, when you leave, John Howard didn't like me, and I was the first one of the office to be kicked out. You have 2 or 3 weeks in the job before you actually have to, you're officially sacked.
Yeah.
So I stayed in Downer's office and organising my overseas trip. 95.
So. You mentioned, you said John Howard didn't like you.
Oh, I'd done a report many, many years ago when I was working at Old Parliament House for radio. John Howard was leader. They'd come back from a break, and that had a fairly ordinary question time. And I'd done a Q&A. I went straight to air afterwards, saying that it was a perfect opportunity. The government was in trouble and the opposition hadn't made the most of it. And I'd gone in fairly hard. But I was first up. The other journos thought the same thing, but they were writing for papers or they were doing a story for PM. I was up straight after question time doing a Q&A. And he was very angry and called the station and told them I was biased, and the station loved it. There's a bit of biffo on air. So he never liked that. And he'd actually warned Downer not to employ me because he thought I was Labor. And that's a mistake that the Liberals often make, that if a journalist does a tough story, they assume that they're biased. And while the general leaning of the press gallery is slightly left of centre, or way left, you might have some way left and some way right, but the general tone belief of the press gallery is slightly left. If you're good at your job, you'll get a fair go. Mm-hmm. I say to them, it's like being female. You've just got to work harder and be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's interesting that he would have remembered that.
John Howard has a very long memory.
Yeah,
sure. Mrs. Howard even remembered one time. I'd done a story when I worked at AAP when Howard became leader over Peacock, and he'd been holidaying at the Snow with the family, and I was a junior reporter then, so I got to interview Mrs. Howard at AAP. And so just in the questions, you know, one of the questions to her was, how did you explain it to the children? She explained it to the children by saying, well, Daddy's got Mr. Peacock's job. Well, that was the lead to my story, and given it's AAP, it ran everywhere. And I don't think they liked that as well, because I mentioned that when many years later I mentioned to Mrs. Howard, oh, you might recall many years ago I interviewed you, and she just said, oh yes, and walked away. She wasn't impressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they remember. Yeah, well, you're away for a year on that overseas
Just
trip,
about
right?
a year, yeah. I came back in time for Christmas and also in time for the 96 election campaign. I figured that still hooked on politics, and if I didn't get a job that related to the campaign or afterwards, I would just pack up my bags and go overseas again.
Did you work overseas at all?
Oh, briefly as a nanny.
Oh, okay.
In New York.
Not as a journalist.
No. I worked for a journalist as a nanny. Yeah, that's a whole other story.
So after about a year, you've still got politics in your blood. You're interested
yes.
in what's happening. I guess you were following Australian events, were you?
Not so much when I was overseas. And there's a whole gap when I came back where people would talk about something that had happened. And I'd say, well, did that happen in 1995? Because remember, we didn't have the internet, and in those days when you travelled, you really, really were out of touch. And I think that's something we've lost,
yeah.
and some of us have experienced now, but we're the last generation to experience travelling overseas, being completely out of touch.
Yeah.
And there's a real freedom in that. There's a real sense of freedom and fear at sometimes, depending where you end up. So... I knew when the election was going to be. When I came back, I went down to Torquay and stayed at my mother's place because I'd rented my apartment out. And the two friends that I might have shared with or just moved into their house, you know, you have some friends you can just move in. Mm. One of them had gone to Sydney and the other one had gone to India. So I didn't really want to just, you know, plonk myself down in Canberra. So I stayed in Torquay and did a few things there, spoke at the local Probus Club and little things like that. Came up to Canberra for a week or so to see if there was anything around. Andrew Robb was running the Liberal Party. He wasn't interested. So I went back to Torquay, then got Mum's car and went to Adelaide. Got some very dear friends in Adelaide. And I was just in Adelaide talking to the local Libs to see if there was anything going. And I was walking up King William Street, and I can still see it. I was walking up King William Street the day the election was called, and for some reason, John Howard had been in Adelaide when the election was called. Of course, being opposition leader, he wasn't in control of the date. And Graham Morris, who was a loyal and faithful servant of John Howard's for many, many years, was walking down the street the other way. I said, "Oh, hi, Graham." He was deep in thought. And he took one look and he said, pointed at me and he said, you, when can you get to Canberra? We need you there. And sheer luck, because if John Howard knew, he might not have agreed to it, for starters. Yeah. But working in the Canberra office meant that I wasn't in touch with him very much at all. Because in opposition, in those days, they had two media advisors. And the two media advisors would be needed for travelling during the campaign. I was in the perfect position of, even though I'd been away for a year, I could come back and waltz up to the press gallery. And the journalists who weren't travelling on the campaign, there were still many journalists. I reported one campaign from Canberra. In fact, these days, most of it's done from Canberra. In those days, the senior journos would be travelling, stop in Canberra for a bit of a break and then go back travelling again. But the mid-level journalists were all here. So I had three volunteers in the media office, and I came up here and had the use of Downer's car, his car in Canberra, and the apartment of, or the room of a friend of mine who was travelling with his boss on the election campaign. So we did it all on the cheap. And that was a really interesting campaign. I was part of the 6:30 media call in the mornings, which I did from home because I'm not a morning person. And then I had the shower, came to the office and worked. We managed to work a six-day week during the campaign, which was really good. Usually it's a seven-day week in a campaign. But we organised it so that the senior volunteer... I came in sometimes, but he was pretty good. I think he did Saturdays and I did Sundays because not a lot happened on Saturdays. I think that was the way it was. And one of the younger volunteers. And then we'd swap and do the other weekend day with just two of us on staff. And it was a fascinating campaign to be involved in.
Did you, you must have met Howard again at some point there.
Yes. It's so busy, he barely noticed I was there. I spoke to him a couple of times to talk through media strategy from when we were in Canberra, but also remember his media advisors had been dealing with the press gallery anyway. So if the leader was in town, so were his other media advisors and so were all the journos. So I was very much in the background, I guess, doing a lot of running around and building up the story with the journos and making sure, you know, things were running smoothly, any stories, feedback, coordinating different stories, yeah.
Did you have a title, like in as a designated kind of position?
I probably did, but I wouldn't have a clue what it was. I was more interested in doing the job.
And were you employed on a contract for this?
Or contract with the Liberal Party.
I see.
Yeah, so it was, and I had to send in a bill, an invoice at the end of it, which I, you know, I only sent an invoice for a couple hundred bucks to cover costs because in an election campaign they get a lot of volunteers.
Mm.
And so I basically covered the costs and minimal, very, very minimal salary for doing it, as you do. I wanted a job.
Did you have strong views in favour of, I know, you know, you've indicated you've been a Liberal supporter, but with Keating, did you feel that he was completely off the track or... You know, was
no,
there a strong
no.
commitment? Or?
It went, the support for the Liberals went right back to when I was much younger. And I think I would have mentioned that I felt very strongly that Labor was out of touch with the working class and more in touch with academic and intellectual labour. And most of my friends are Labor. And it reinforces that view. I'm the only working class person they know.
Mm.
And both sides of politics have a tendency to do it, and the media certainly does. They are not in touch with your average Australian. And I am less and less so, but you know, I do go home to family from time to time. I do have friends who, in fact, I caught up with some of them on the weekend. They live in the bush. They haven't been to uni. They're happy, get on with life, and their view of politics is not built on an understanding of politics. It's built on an impression.
Okay, yep.
And do these politicians know us or care about us? And their views on, you know, all the sorts of stuff that might make you angry on immigration and working standards and unions, as they have very strong views and you might consider them right wing. They're not as bad as the One Nation views, but they're there and they should be respected, and that's why I have a strong view that that's why One Nation appeared. We've lost touch with the people who really care and really vote, you know, who count and who vote, and we're not talking to them. We're talking to intellectual labour. We're talking to educated Australia, and that's not the whole country.
Mm-hmm. And did you bring that idea as much as you could to Howard's campaign? Or?
A bit to Howard's campaign, but it was more in the Downer campaign to be leader. In fact, when he got the leadership job and the pollster came around with all these the polls and the reviews and the focus group stuff, and he was just going through and he had all these graphs and comments, Downer just kept looking at me saying, that's what you said. So I like to think, and I've still got a couple of political friends who will call me for those views now, which is nice, because it's nice to think I still can do that, even though I don't spend a lot of time, you know, outside the world of you know, educated Australia, I guess.
And the parties of pr- probably become more removed in a sense. I mean, I just read Barry Cohen's piece in Today's Australian.
Have you read that? No, I didn't know. I was coming here. I didn't read this. Right.
Very interesting statistical analysis of the Labor Party caucus when he became a member in the 60s, comparing it to today by occupation.
You know,
nearly all former people who left uni and worked for the party or a union or whatever. And so there is that.
There's a disconnect. There's a disconnect, and it's we're seeing it in the and we're on a different topic now, but we're seeing it in the public views of the leaders we have now, is that they're false, and that's because they don't really, the advice they're getting is the intellectual, educated advice, coupled with the focus group surveys that are telling them what others are thinking, and they're trying to marry the two. I don't know what the answer is. There's got to be a better way of doing it.
And I suppose the focus groups that matter to them are the ones in marginal seats, so they're, it's further skewed by that ending up with policies geared to those people.
Those people are in all seats. It's just that it's only worth spending the money in them. In the marginal seats, they're not going to do focus groups in other seats. No, these people exist all around Australia, and they have a right to be informed. And we're not informing them